ChristmasRising.com.
I just bought in the museum a book I didn't bring, Bat Menorot, and I was amazed to see dozens, scores, menorot, Chanukiyot, both, but especially menorot. To my mind, not a single one was right. How could Jews go for hundreds upon hundreds of years having the most sacred object and nobody understand what they are? I see the samples, what they do in Machon HaMikdash. Lollipop. Poppycock, how do you say this? When they say there are 22 kaftorim, not 5% of all the menorot that I've seen have this feature. And now for me, 22 kaftorim, wow, this is it, man. This is Sefer Yetzirah, all enfolded in one object. You know, kaftorim are buttons, are keypads, are what we use with a computer all the time. 22, yes, for all the letters, from Aleph to Taf. The menorah is an input device. Or maybe they're communicating the other way around, that any message that can be spelled in Hebrew words, that is all the Torah, can be communicated through the menorah. And how is the menorah done? Three legs down, seven up. These are the numbers of Sefer Yetzirah. But you already have here like a neuron connection of many to many. This transformation from the three below to the seven above, and you have all the spherot, or you turn it around, and you have the three supernals and the seven below. We have an object which, in a sense, symbolizes our identity. That's a Jewish national symbol, and yet, to my mind, hardly people have started to explore and understand it after 3,000 years. To me, the Torah is much the same. I was so surprised. I dedicated 12 years to the study of Bereshit. I came with results now that publishers don't dare to publish it because it's so new, so radical. It's so like nothing that has been taught before. For instance, it's the Torah is about Israel. It's not about the Jewish people. But we are so accustomed to think in such terms. People speak it automatically. When you read an Israeli reading of the Torah, it's different from a Jewish reading of the Torah. And it could not have come before we have returned to the land. I guess it couldn't have happened before. I think there are many surprises and many new discoveries which are awaiting to us in the land, because, as Menachem said, because we work here on much extended modality of the concrete, the mundane, and the sublime together, and more dimensions of experience, more dimensions of being, more exploration of them. So I think that our synagogues, for instance, new ones, will be much more interconnected, and the interaction of people within the synagogue will not just be all in one body doing this, but more like makhelot, you know, that's choirs, that something is moving. Incidentally, there is a beautiful work by an ex-judge called Bazak, I think, or Barak, about the psalms. He shows how the psalms were sung when the groups, were choirs, were standing in geometrical patterns and producing with the psalms patterns of sounds, you know, coming from here to there and tying it together. That's much more enriching the modalities. It is no longer linear, even if the song is going, because there is the intertwining of it. So with this, I'm passing to our great artist.
Yeah, the menorah is interesting. I when I was in New York last, I was walking on the street and I saw a sign in the bank, and it said Christmas Club, Hanukkah Club, and it had two symbols: the Christmas tree as a triangle pointing up, a pine kind of tree. And the Chanukiah as a menorah pointing down, the Rambam Lubavitch type menorah that is a triangle going down. And so you have two different triangles here, a triangle going up that's closed form, and a triangle going down that's opened at the top. You see, that goes up. I think that to me, the symbolization here, and we're talking about Hellenism and Judaism as far as Hanukkah is concerned, and one represents Hellenism and one represents Judaism. And Hellenism that led to much Western spirituality, in a sense, was the idea of how do you become more spiritual? You get up to be higher, away from the material world, to more spiritual world. I mean, the most important book probably written, early book on modern art is Kandinsky's book, Concerning the Spiritual in Art. And his metaphor throughout the whole book is a triangle going up. You know, upward and outward is the word he uses continually. It's a triangle going up, away from the material world to some spiritual realm where you just deal with colors and patterns. You know, and that was his idea of modernism, that like in music, you deal with sounds and pitch and so on. You just deal with colors and patterns, and you move up that way. I think the triangle going down is closer, is the Jews don't, I mean, Judaism doesn't negate that. I mean, there are aspects of that, maybe like tefillah and meditation and stuff, that going up. But that isn't the essence of Judaism. The essence of Judaism is that triangle going down, the menorah that goes this way. And that the idea is to bring the light, the spiritual light, down into the everyday world, to bring the spirituality into every aspect of life. Remember, I had the schut to have a conversation on these things since 1961 with the Rebbe Lubavitch. You know, and he told me once, you know, the word spiritual material is in essence the same word backwards. If you take ruach, which is spiritual, and chomer, which is material, and interchange the middle letters, the vav and mem, there are the letters bumaf, the bet men, vav and pei, letters that are said with the lips, are interchangeable letters. And so the mem and vav are, in essence, interchangeable letters. So ruach, the word spiritual and material, is the same word backwards. So he said, you know, what's the difference between the spiritual world and a material world? It's zavitria, it's your perception, your angle of vision, your perspective. If you look at the world and see a material world, well, it'll be a material world for you. But if you can make a switch in your mind and look at that same world, you transform it into a spiritual world. In Judaism, the material world and the spiritual world is the same world. It's just the quality of our perception and relationship to that world that makes it spiritual. And I remember shortly after this conversation with the Rebbe, this Yechidus with the Rebbe, I came to Israel to a conference on art and science with Adin Steinsaltz, Rabbi Steinsaltz. And I told him what the Rebbe had said to me. And he said, do you know, the statement for the ultimate gashmiut, the ultimate crass materiality in Western culture, is wine, women, and song. That's an English expression. Wine, women, and song. The ultimate statement of materiality. But Jews say kiddush on wine, kiddushin on women, and shira shirim is the highest level of spirituality. Kodesh kodeshim. So what's the holy of holies? We say kiddush on wine, you know, which means sanctification. Holy matrimony is called kiddushin, and the Song of Songs is considered the holiest book of the Tanakh. So what is the holy of holies in Judaism? Wine, women, and song. The whole of Judaism is the transformation of the most crass material world into the spiritual one. It's both. If you go from the ultimate mitnagid of Rav Soloveitchik, that's his whole book, Ishalacha, is about that, or the ultimate chassid of the Rebbe Lubavitch, says the exact same thing. You know, that's what Yadut is about. It's about that, you know. And I think that you talked about Yehuda and Israel. And I take another take on it somewhat. And, you know, there's an in-between stage that I see. I think that This story was played out with the Miraglim, the spies who were sent to spy out Israel. And you had representatives of all of the tribes, the leadership of all of the tribes. And I sent in to report back on going into Eretz Israel. And 10 of them came back and said, let's not do it. You know, they weren't able to. And two of them said, let's go in to Eretz Israel. Yehoshua. And Yehoshua was really, really, and Kalev. And Kalev, it said he had Ruach Acheret. He had a different spirit. Only about Kalev. Of all of the 12 Meraglim, it only says that about Kalev. Yehoshua, or Joshua, said, let's go into Eretz Israel, because he was a Yelet Tov, a good boy. He was Moshe's right-hand man. So he said, Moshe Rabbeinu heard from the God. We got to go into Eretz Israel. There's no question about it. You know, he was doing what he was supposed to do. But Kalev had another vision. He was able to make this transition, to be able to see the spiritual in the material world that the other ones couldn't see. And what did they want? And that was an ultimate sin, what they said. They were sentenced to death. That was capital punishment for what they did. They were going to die in the desert. And what did they want to do? They wanted a kolel. They wanted to study Torah. That's what they wanted to do. They said, why that? Should we go into Eretz Israel? It's like going back to slavery in Mitzrayim. We have to collect garbage. We got to fight wars. We got to grow our food. What's the sense? Let's stay in the desert. Can study Torah day and night. We have our food delivered to us at the Petach Ohel, you know, at the opening of the tent every morning. We just go get collect it. Chalukah. You know, yeah, Chalukah. I mean, that's our charity. And we sit in Kollel all the time and study Torah. And what was the reward for saying I want to study Torah all the time? It was a death penalty. That isn't what Judaism's about. Judaism is to go into Eretz Israel and collect garbage and fight wars and and grow food, you see. And Kalev could see that. And in fact, it's the descendants of Kalev that came back to Eretz Israel 2,000 years. Yeah. Kalev is the Shevet of Yehuda. And the Jews came back because of Kalev. The other tribes couldn't come back until they made that transition. But Israel isn't ready to come back yet. We're sort of getting pieces of it in. But only the people, I mean, when I sit in my class in school, I'm teaching the Kohanim and Levim, but they weren't one of the Meraglim. They weren't in that job. So they're the ones who came back. The other ones, maybe we have part of Dan with the Ethiopians. Maybe we find Menashe here. I think that, like Yitzchak's talking about, Israel, well, ultimately we need to be all the tribes of Israel together. But only now. A lot of people, one of the nice things one of the ways to understand this very well, the Rebbe of Sadagora was humiliated by the Nazis during the Holocaust. They wanted to humiliate him in front of his congregation. So they put a gun to his head and they say, what you have to do is collect garbage and clean the streets. All day long, every day get up early and work as a garbage man cleaning the streets and collecting garbage. And at night you need to march through the streets with the Nazi flag. That's what their ultimate humiliation of this man. And he survived the Holocaust, moved to Tel Aviv. And before Yom HaAtzmaut, before Israel Independence Day, for the whole week before that, he got up early in the morning and worked with the sanitation department of Tel Aviv, collecting garbage and sweeping the streets of Tel Aviv, and marching at night through the streets with the Israeli flag. And he said, what a great zchut I have, what a great privilege I have that I can keep the Jewish city, this new Hebrew city, clean. What an amazing thing. We know what happens if you have a garbage strike, what a horrible thing is to live in. What a great honor I have to be able to keep our city clean and then to walk with my own flag down the street. And he was like Kalev. He could see, I mean, what's the difference between what he did? It was the doing it as Bnei Chorin, you know, as a free man, and doing it as a slave. And I think that I mean, the Zionist challenge here is to be able to make that transformation of seeing every aspect of our life in Eretz Israel, every as a spiritual act.
The last thing you told us about this sweeping the floors reminded me. Down the street here, I have a very dear friend who was a movie maker and became a chozer b'tshuva, became religious. And he knows that he doesn't like Kabbalah, mysticism, and so. But he knows about my interest with the temple. And he told me one day, you know what I would really love to do? I would love to be in the temple and to have a broomstick and to clean the courts of the temple. If I really, you know, could have my way, if I could, this is what I would love to do. And you said something about perspectives and change of perspective, that we can look from up to down and from down up, and it depends on our perspective what we see. I think it's very true, and that one, as one develops spiritually, it's this ability, to my mind, to change the perspective, to realize that paradise, that heaven, that Eden is already here, only people don't notice it. And because they don't notice it, it doesn't materialize enlarge. I've been working on the question of the temple, so-called third temple, for many years, maybe 20 years. It took me many years to realize that the temple already exists. And there is nothing wrong with the Dome of the Rock. It's probably much better than most structures that people would nowadays love to put substitutes of the second temple. It's a better design for it. We can add things in the skies of Jerusalem. I hope when you have the visuals, I'm sure. But in fact, potentially, everything is here. It depends on people's eyes to open, on their mentality to make a little shift. And then problems are solved. Things which seem impossible become entertainment rather than, a cause for grief. So I think we need, when we go near this holiday of the Hanukkah, where miracles happen, and the miracle of the light, to remember that what we are talking about is a certain shift in the perception, which is the metaphor of turning on the light where there was no light before. The place is exactly the same as it was before, with light, without light. But when there is a light, you know how to operate gracefully in the place where if you walk in a darkness, you just stumble in the very same place. So I would like to invite more reflections about our Hanukkah lights.
Well, I would like to go back and talk about the triangle. The Zionist Congress wanted to create a Jewish symbol. So they took the what we call the Magen David and put it on this flag that the Sadagora Rebbe had, right? But if you look at the two triangles, they're superimposed one on another. In other words, you can lift them off. The classic Jewish model is like this, that they're integrated. You cannot separate them. That each bar is connected to the other. So the first thing is that it's not just the two triangles, which depending which way you go, it's that they're inseparable. So they're basically the same, what the Rebbe was talking about. The other thing is also interesting, is that you talk about the spies. It's exactly from the spies that you get the word Eda in Hebrew, from which we get the idea that a community is 10 people, which in the synagogue became the model of services. You need a minyan in order to say certain public prayers. Now, What happens if you have a community in virtual space? Do you need 10? Can they be distributed around the planet? Do you need an ADAI? In other words, when you talk about shifting your perspectives and shifting your frame of reference, is it limited to locality, or is it now the ability to do this on a global scale? More than that, when you talk about the issue of the of Hanukkah, of the Nes, you're talking, Menachem, about atoms based on carbon atoms. Us, people, human beings. What's going to happen with intelligent robots? Is there a possibility of having spiritual robots? In other words, that we move, I don't know, beyond, but different than the issue of consciousness only inhering in carbon-based systems. Kurzweil says yes. At least that's what he writes. I mean, there are a lot of people that are thinking about that. And the other thing I want to mention is very interesting. The most ancient graphic that I know of that uses the triangle is the Sri Yantra in India. It goes back, I don't know, 7,000 years. Well, it's 9, and it's the symbol of creation. We use this in order to create the new Jew, we, the Zionists. The other thing I want to mention is that you mentioned before, Yoram, about the Chadesh Amenu Kedem. Kedem basically is the Orient. We are in Asia. We got to begin to think that the Jewish community is not limited to its battle with the Greeks, with the Hellenists. That's all that we deal with, or with Christianity, or now with Islam. We are in a unique situation where the next century, too, the real power is going to be in India and China. The West has had its day, probably, whatever it is. The Jews are in Asia. Israel is in Asia.
The West Coast.
Yeah, I want to make a point about this. It seems that one of the characteristics of Jews is that knowingly or unknowingly, they like to move to where the action is. And so you can say that this return to Zion is something that precedes this rise of the East that you're talking about, India and China. Nowadays, young Israelis, when they finish the army, they go to India. They used to go to Europe. They used now they are going to India and to Thailand. And I think what is forming now within this globalization of humankind, that come new concepts of where is the center point of humankind. And it by now, to be politically correct, it must be in Asia, because that's where two-thirds of humankind live. So certainly somehow the center is in Asia. But again, politically correct, it cannot be in India or in China, because if it's in India, why is it not in China? And if it's in China, why is it not in India? Because they're so big. Like with the European Union, you couldn't have it in France or Germany. So it had to go to the small country there. I think the same. It got to be in Asia, but it got to be in the place in Asia that is best connected spiritually, historically, and so also with the West. In other words, gentlemen, it's where we are now. Right now, it's still not politically correct to put it, because we still have to convince the Muslims that what Muhammad was praying for 13 years out of his 22 years of career is the right direction. They would rather turn around from it, but they are also oriented in such a way, let alone Christian Zionists from the West, let alone I get all kinds of correspondence from the East, of people getting interested. So I think our meeting here around this round table next to the Old City is we are training to do such round table business for all sections and representations of humankind.
It's you started, Moshe, talking about my last book, but I have a contract to deliver my next book this month, tonight I'm giving up time from working on that, but my new book, which I'm editing rather than writing, which I thought of, is called Educating Artists for the Future, and the subtitle is Learning at the Intersections of Art, Science, Technology, and Culture. And it'll be done this month. And I invited 20 other art educators like myself to contribute chapters to it all over the world. And one of the, and when I, before I you know, did this book, and there is no book on educating artists for the future in a digital, post-digital age. And so this is going to be a really important book. And before I did this book, I wanted to see if there were other books in this field and if there were other things. I couldn't find anything on the – the only thing I found on the Internet about educating artists, you know, in the digital age was a conference held in Hong Kong about 3 years ago, an Asian conference. All the participants were Asians on this subject. And I noticed one of the participants from professor in China, interesting man, has biography, PhD in biomedical engineering, and who turned up, went over to computer graphics and art and became an art professor, you know, but he presented a paper on ancient Taoist spirituality and the digital age. And so I wanted to track him because I write about Kabbalah and Judaism in the digital age. And I said, oh, wow, I should find out what he wrote. So I tried to track him down, but his name must have been like Cohen or Smith or something. I couldn't find him on the Internet anywhere. And I finally found that he had a sabbatical for a year, and he went to the University of Plymouth in England working with Roy Ascott, who's a good friend of mine, and so on. He was in England. Tracked him down. So I said, hey, can you send me that paper? I do things like that. And he said, sure. You know, and he emailed me his paper, and I sent him the stuff I wrote about Kabbalah. And I got it on a Friday before my son Ron came up from Yerucham. My son Ron's a rabbi, studies Kabbalah for years and years. And here I had this paper, and it was uncanny. I was reading Kabbalah. You know, it talked about, like, Sfirot within Sfirot. It talked about the connections between them. I mean, it was about Kabbalah. And here was a paper from ancient Taoist things. And I showed it to Ron, and I said, look at this. What do you make of this, you know? So, yeah, it's amazing. It's really amazing. I mean, what kind of contact did we have 3,000 years ago with China? I don't know. Maybe it's encoded in the DNA of humanity that we all come up with this idea from our different ways of experiencing the world. But this was unbelievable. And he read my Kabbalah thing. He said, you know, what is... And then I met him this summer in Plymouth. I was at a conference there on Consciousness Reframed, and we both made presentations. I talked about the talis, the tzitzis, that I gave a whole thing, wearing a talis with tzitziot. And that was I talk about how biomorphic consciousness is structured by tzitziot. And biblical fringes, that was the title of my thing. Biomorphic consciousness shaped by biblical fringes. So anyhow, he wrote a wonderful chapter for my book, and I have an Indian professor, right, wrote a chapter on ancient Indian philosophies and relation to the digital, and it's going to be it's a wonderful book, that's a nice, interesting idea, Yitzhak, the idea that they put the EU center in Brussels at the edge, you know. And Israel's like the edge of Asia, where, you know, but didn't you once showed me a model like of Asia, Africa, and Europe with a balance point. Was that you, Shota?
That was you. Wasn't that you?
I think it was
classic.
Yeah, the balance point is
Jerusalem.
Is Jerusalem. I think years ago you once showed me that. Yeah. And so I think that's interesting. And it's interesting because this dialogue, my youngest son just came back last night from Brussels, where he was at the European Union, with his class from the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya. They took the whole group to the European Union in Brussels. You know, he's this Argov fellow of the top students, and they took the 19 top students to Brussels. But he spent the summer in China at the university in Beijing, and made all kinds of relations. He really spent Rosh Hashanah in Chabad, Beijing. And so it's this whole concept. And I really think that that's really interesting, Moshe, what you're bringing up, that that we are Asian. And I once built a sukkah in Munich as a artwork, and this Japanese artist Hiroid, one of the greatest kite maker of Japan, also professor of art at Tokyo University, and he came by and saw myself and another American artist building the sukkah, and he said, "Oh, beautiful Japanese building! I help you build this." And I said, gee, we'd love to have your help. Thank you. And he was a really good carpenter, not like me and Uri Levy from MIT, who we weren't such good carpenters. But he really helped us. And all the time, he used to stand in the sukkah while we were building. He said, oh, beautiful Japanese building. Oh, beautiful. And we said, it's not a Japanese building. It's a Jewish building. Finally, we agreed it's an Asian building. And he invited me because it had, the kind of architecture of Japan with the rice paper kinds of walls and stuff. It reminded him, and Hiroi invited me to lecture at the University of Tokyo, and I went there, and I decided to mark the edges of Asia, and I took a train about 2 hours through the 2.5 hours through the rice paddies from Tokyo. I looked at the easternmost point of Asia, which is Chikura, a fishing village in Japan, and I took earth sand from the beach in Tel Aviv, the west coast of Asia. And I was going to mark the parentheses of Asia, and the bracket Asia. And I took a stick right where the stand is, and I made a parentheses mark. And I should say, when I got off at the train station and took a taxi to the beach, I had no idea I was going to find a volcanic beach with black sand. And here I had the yellow sand from Tel Aviv, and I put a stick and I filled it with the yellow sand from Tel Aviv. And then I took the black sand from Chikura, flew back to Tel Aviv and made the other parentheses. I photographed them, so you have a band of, you've seen that, so you've seen it also, and I made a serigraph at the Burston Center that used to be. I was invited by the Israel Museum to do, and I did that, and it's actually in a collection of the Emperor of Japan. And so I photographed it, and you have the sand and the surf and the sky of both places with the parentheses. And then I wrote around it in Hebrew. I wrote, so Graham Shalasia, and I wrote it in Hebrew. A friend of mine whose wife's Japanese wrote it in Japanese, and then I wrote it in English. And you have another parentheses because English goes Hebrew goes from the right to left, and Japanese from top to bottom, and English from left to right. And so it's a beautiful serigraph that is in a number of museums and in a collection of the Emperor of Japan, who's an oceanographer. But I think that's very. I think we need to really explore more further our really positioning of ourselves now, the major body. Now we have the major Jewish community in the world in Asia.